Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail. Here are your hosts, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling.
Welcome to this special edition of the Retail Focus Podcast. I'm Trent Kling. Notoriously missing, actually, is Leighton Kling. He is out on business and his busy travel schedule wouldn't allow for a podcast recording. So, as I mentioned, we've got a special episode today, couple of interviews, and then we'll preview what we'll talk about here in a few days once Leighton can settle down and record. A reminder that you can like us and rate us however you do access us, whether that be on Spotify, whether that be on Apple Podcasts, any podcast listening service, you can rate us out there. Also, you can check us out on Twitter and Instagram at Retail Podcast. So the first interview today, and I think this is something that everyone out there will certainly want to hear. IBM has run a number of studies getting consumer data, not only in regards to what they've been buying, but also their intent as far as purchasing over the next couple of months. And here to discuss that with us is Carl Haller of IBM. He's the global head for IBM's Consumer Center of Competency, and he's going to discuss some of their recent findings from their study. And that's right after this brief break. Now that we've seen pandemic buying conditions for the better part of 2 months, we're starting to generate significant data surrounding how and where people are spending in retail. And who better to collect and report on that data than the ever ubiquitous IBM. And to that end, we're pleased to be joined today by Carl Haller, the global lead for IBM's Consumer Center of Competency, to discuss their findings that were released in a recent study. The study, by the way, is titled COVID-19 is Significantly Altering U.S. Consumer Behavior and Plans Post-Crisis. Carl, thank you so much for joining us today on the podcast.
Oh, well, thank you. Very happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
First, anytime we talk about a study on the podcast, we'd like to discuss the methods involved in the study. And I was wondering if you could maybe shine some light on how the research was conducted, the size of the survey group as far as the consumers and that type of thing.
Sure, be happy to. So within IBM, we have our Institute for Business Value, which we refer to as the IBV. So IBM IBV. And we regularly speak to consumers in the US and all over the world. This particular study was a study of approximately 25,000 adults in the U.S. conducted in April, between the 1st and the 26th of April, to understand how U.S. consumers are being impacted and affected by COVID-19 and to get their perspectives on a number of issues ranging from retail and shopping to transportation to their willingness to re-engage in public venues and returning back to work.
As you kind of alluded to, the study also discusses consumers' future plans, which we'll get to in a moment, but it seemed like the headlines of the findings as far as the shopping that's already occurred from these consumers is that honestly, people are still very much getting out and shopping, but the how and the where of it is changed. I was wondering if you could provide a little color to that.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I'd say in general, consumers are not really ready to fully re-engage in society. They are shopping. You know, they're certainly buying essential goods when they're heading out. For the most part, there's been a big slowdown in their purchases of non-essential goods. I think part of that is from the product side, but also just from the supply side, that most of those stores in most parts of the country are not open, or certainly were not open in the month of April when this study was conducted. But we are seeing people heading out and buying, you know, the various types of essential goods and services. So grocery, some home improvement products, and a few other kind of odds and ends that you find at some of the larger mass merchandise discounter stores.
I think one of the most interesting parts about the retail part of the survey, at least, is that there seems to be a differing approach to how shoppers are getting out and shopping based on region. What are you seeing as far as effects from region to region in the U.S.?
So a lot of that is really tracing what's happening with the different shutdowns and with the outbreaks. So, for example, in the Northwest, which had an earlier outbreak and frankly, which It's one of the top regions in the country in terms of flattening the curve early. We're seeing some re-engagement out in shopping there, whereas we're seeing very little of that behavior in the Northeast.
And I know one of the other big topics has been payment. Certainly in retail marketing and messaging, we're seeing a lot of ideas around maybe alternate or contactless forms of payment. But what are the consumers saying about maybe their willingness or the desire to do so?
Yeah, I think that's one of those things that contactless payments, touchless payments, that's been out in the marketplace in various forms for the past few years. This is something that we think is going to have a very significant acceleration, and the data supports that. You know, we've got, I think, just about 40% of consumers from our study saying they are increasingly likely to use a touchless or contactless payment type when they're shopping than they were before. So we're seeing a significant growth in contactless and touchless.
And then one of the other aspects I wanted to talk about just from the study and the raw data is that we're seeing a bit of a transition or a bit of a shift, if you will, towards maybe people looking at supporting local businesses or shopping more local. Is there some momentum that we're seeing according to the data towards maybe shopping local or people wanting to support those local businesses?
Yeah, so I think, you know, it's funny. This is one we really wanted to understand because we think it's going to happen. The data, frankly, is a bit mixed. And I think it's mixed because the supply of local merchants that you're able to shop is varied. And so when, even if there is a desire to shop, and we do see that there is an intended willingness to shop local, it was, I believe, approximately a fourth of the respondents saying they are shopping more often at locally owned stores, and they're buying more local made or locally grown and sourced products. Right now, that's being impacted by the lack of supply or consistent supply of those goods and services that consumers can buy. We believe that as the supply comes back online and as the country starts to open up in the months of May and June and July, we're going to see those numbers increase because we're seeing an increased importance on people and place with regard to where goods come from and how they are made and moved and, frankly, who all's touched it, as from the time it started to the time it arrives in your hands as a consumer.
Because of this emphasis on local, and one of the other things I'll mention is we talked to someone on the show last week talking about traffic trends surrounding commercial real estate, and the grocery anchored centers, the neighborhood centers are seeing a little bit more traffic than other places. So how can retailers, looking kind of at the big picture beyond this study, respond to these trends, the trends of the desire to go maybe more local or not travel as far to gather their goods?
Yeah, and I think there are going to be a number of implications that are coming out of this for retailers. And at the broader level, you know, from the data we see in this study and beyond, we believe that the COVID-19 crisis is creating the proverbial burning platform that will push retailers to make some of the fundamental changes to their business operating model that they've long considered, contemplated, known about, but to date, they haven't really had the true need to make it. And now, as many of them are facing store closures, changes in real estate decisions, the need to shift their business more to a digital-first posture, and the need to adjust their supply chain and balance agility with efficiency, we think we're going to see a lot of changes really across the board for both essential and non-essential retailers.
And I wanted to touch on that. You brought up not only in your last answer, but earlier in terms of getting the supply chain back online, getting product flow back online with some retailers. What can retailers take from this experience as far as maybe supply chain mechanisms that need to be in place or should be in place if we do see future spikes in demand or panic buying as a result of maybe some future black swan event?
It's a very good question and one we're talking with a number of clients about. So, you know, in the near term right now, what we're seeing is a lot of move toward, frankly, just augmenting the supply chain, opening up new sources of supply, especially the essential retailers, so they can get goods and get them into the hands of consumers who need them. The other thing that we're doing a lot of work with our retail and consumer packaged goods clients on is understanding how the reopening is going to unfold and what that's going to mean on demand patterns at a localized level. As we play this forward, we believe that certainly for the next 18 to 24 and maybe even 36 months, this is going to be a very uneven road back. There will be probably additional hotspots or additional flashpoints of outbreaks. There will be parts of the country which will be in better or worse economic shape, and this will not be an even steady recovery. It's more important than ever to run the business locally, to understand what are the actual on-the-ground conditions at the neighborhood or city level, and then how do you create the operational agility to respond to those changing conditions in real time or at least in near real time. That has implications on operations, that has implications on supply chain and better managing the mismatches in supply and demand that will occur city by city. And it has implications on things like marketing and communication and promotions with consumers.
Looking outside this scope, and I wanted to kind of finish here because you're in this fantastic position where you're at IBM. IBM, of course, works with so many retailers out there above and beyond supply chain, above and beyond some of, you know, maybe what you might call the common sense takeaways from this. What are other things that come up in conversations surrounding retailers that maybe those on the outside might not realize either need to be changed or could well be on its way to changing over the next 1 to 2 years as far as how retailers run things?
That's another great question. There are some common themes that we're seeing across the industry right now. And it is different if you're a non-essential business that has been closed with, you know, anywhere from 0% to 20% of your normal revenue coming in versus an essential retailer, you know, a grocery store that's seeing spikes of, you know, 20, 30, 40%. But in general, the playbook right now is understand how and where you generate cash and where you consume cash and figure out ways to build as big of cash reserves as you can. The second theme is understand your business operating model, specifically around the cost structure, and look to one, reduce cost, but two, shift to a more variable cost model. Most retailers run on a, you know, more of a high fixed cost model, so that steady sales growth of, you know, anywhere from 2 to 8% generates an outsized gain in the operating profit for the company. As the economy fluctuates more and as the environment fluctuates, especially at a local level, the need to be able to weather ups and downs is going to be more critical. So that's going to be better weathered by a variable cost model. And so that's going to take a big fundamental shift. The third piece, which we talked about somewhat, is this shift toward digital first and customer centric. And again, that's something I would say most retailers say, yes, they take a digital first approach, and of course they're customer centric, but they haven't fully made all of the changes to the business operating model that allow them to do those things organizationally with aligned budgets and with metrics that support those types of behaviors. Businesses tend to still be managed at the channel level, at the functional level, rather than starting with the customer as a P&L unit and building up from there. The fourth one, which we've also talked about, is supply chain and the shift toward a balance of agility with efficiency. You can't just be agile. You still have to be somewhat efficient in order to serve customers at the price they're willing to pay. But being able to understand those on-the-ground conditions, neighborhood by neighborhood, locality by locality. And it's not just going to be COVID outbreaks. It's going to be what's happening with weather patterns. It's going to be what's happening with localized events that will drive potentially small spikes and troughs in demand, and then reacting to operate the business in response to those spikes and troughs of demand. We think there's going to be a need for certainly more operational monitoring, monitoring how many people are in your store, monitoring if your employees are safe, monitoring if people are keeping social distancing, understanding where potential flashpoints may be occurring, and being able to react to either shut down a single store or potentially shut down a distribution center, but really taking safety of your customers and of your employees into account in a way that we've probably taken for granted, again, outside of those black swan events that you were talking about. Those are some of the common themes that are in the playbook that we think will result in fundamental change to how many retail businesses look and operate going forward.
Some great insight there, and especially the portion about fixed versus variable cost models. We'll keep an eye out for that certainly over the next few years. Well, once again, Carl Haller, IBM, thank you so much for joining us today on the podcast.
Trent, thank you very much.
Well, we thank Carl for joining us, and certainly a lot of great insights, especially about the localization of supply chain. Also, as Carl mentioned, and as we talked about towards the end of that interview, moving from a fixed to a variable cost model, that could be an enormous sea change if retailers do decide to go that route. Now, coming up right after this will be Derek O'Carroll. He's the CEO of Bright Pearl, and we know, as Carl talked about in the previous interview, that more people are going online to shop, certainly. But this has resulted in more people being able to leave reviews than ever. And Derek will talk about the review culture along with a few other things and how Bright Pearl is helping businesses adjust to what could be a new normal. Now, you're probably tired of hearing about how COVID-19 has forced more consumers to shop online than ever before over the past 2 to 3 months. We know that part already. We've discussed it on the show. However, a secondary impact of this is that the flush of online orders that we're seeing leaves a more immediate opportunity for customers to leave reviews. And that's actually one of the things we're going to discuss today among other omnichannel topics. We're joined by Derek O'Carroll, once again, the CEO of Bright Pearl, who provides various services to retailers, including sales order and inventory management. Derek, thank you so much for joining us here on the podcast.
It's a pleasure, Trent. Looking forward to our chat today.
So first, as we so often do on the show, I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about yourself and Bright Pearl, and more importantly, what Bright Pearl does on the day-to-day, so we know where your perspective is coming from in the marketplace.
Yeah, cool. So I suppose at the core, I'm a technologist, got involved in technology startups in the 90s, did a stint about 15 years in security, and then jumped over to retail in 2016 by getting involved in Bright Pearl as the CEO. And I essentially got involved at that time because of the huge shift in the market, as all of your listeners are very aware of, to buyer behavior increasing towards having high levels of personalized service across multiple channels, physical and digital. And I joined back in 2016 because the Bright Pearl team had developed a bunch of technology essentially to automate all of the complexity that occurs when you have to meet that demand across multiple channels. And that's essentially what we do. We have a retail operating platform that plugs into e-commerce sites like Shopify, BigCommerce, and handles all the orchestration across warehouses, 3PL, Amazon, whatever you're doing, and produces your accounts automatically and essentially saves customers time. And we typically serve finished goods merchants. We will do perishable goods like foods next year. And it's across the range from health to sporting to luxury goods and the norm. And about 60% of our business is in North America, and the rest, the other 40% comes from what I call international. So UK, Australia, Germany, Nordics, that sort of mix. So that's a quick overview.
Before we dive into the review part of the interview, I did want to ask you, because you mentioned you're getting into food, getting into perishables next year. What are some of the complexities just from the technical side of things when you're going from, as you say, finished goods to the perishables platform online?
Yeah, so we made a choice 3 years ago to focus on finished goods and the complexities that arise across multiple country, multiple currencies, multiple companies. as you scale up. That's essentially how we've grown our business very successfully over the last 3 years. But it's the same workflows are essentially used by purveyors of goods that have a date on them, essentially. So what we have to do is to make sure that the system has very good capability for managing the consequences of having a perishable good being sold from manufacturing through to sale, and also all of the checks and the hygiene and the associated quality checks that need to be ensured to get that product from A to B. And that's essentially the shift that we're making this year. So it's around serialization and the tech to be able to deal with those new workflows that arise from that. But fundamentally, you know, a merchant's a merchant, and that's what we focus on. So we'll roll that out in Q4 of this year.
I appreciate you shining some light on that for us here. So let's get into it. If you will, what is the review culture? What is what we refer to as review culture as it pertains to retail?
Well, it's the ability to provide an opinion back to a forum, which is then viewable by everyone else, obviously. So you provide a review very quickly, and it's directly linked to someone's experience when a merchant offers up a good to be purchased by that individual. And the review culture is essentially stemmed from a survey we did last year where we interviewed 2,000 consumers in the States, 400 merchants. And we really analyzed 75,000 reviews with the aim of understanding what was the root cause of the review, be it positive and negative. And what we found was customers were very happy when goods arrived on time, when the right good arrived. And I'm sure all your listeners are very familiar with the characteristics of an order being fulfilled successfully. It's you beat the customer's expectations in terms of that order being fulfilled to you, and you get a glowing review from that. And the review is the product arrived, it was great, it was great quality, the tracking insight and visibility of my package as it was coming to me was great. The returns policy was very clear and there was no ambiguity about it. So it's the full life cycle of the customer experience. And it also pertains to multiple channels. So it might be buy online, pick up in store. It might be the same experience when I go back to a merchant site that I saw on the mobile site. So it's all about continuity, same level of high personalized service across multiple channels. And through that survey, we also found the link between good reviews, and this is sort of common sense, but on the inverse of negative reviews, it was the inverse of the same reasons that people were citing for a positive review. So I got a great service, arrived on time. Negative review is it didn't arrive on time. I had a great visibility of when my package was going to arrive. Negative review, I had no visibility of where my package was going to arrive. Positive review would be, I knew exactly what I was getting into with regard to returns and the company fulfilled on that promise. A negative review would be, they said this and they behaved in another way with regard to returns, or when I returned it, I didn't actually realize I had to pay for the returns in the first place, so on and so forth. And the interesting thing for us was when we then went to the merchant side of the equation and we said, okay, guys, what are the reasons why you're not able to get product from A to B when people order those products on multiple channels? And the root cause was typically down to human error within the operational side of the business. So they had a product listed on a website or through a marketplace like Amazon that they actually had already sold in another channel. So overselling is obviously a typical problem. Or when the order came in, there was human error in the pick, pack process to ship process, and the wrong product was put in and that was shipped out. And the list goes on. But essentially, that's what we found out is the review culture, the root cause of negative reviews is the same inverse as the ones of positive reviews, which was common sense, but quite interesting anyway.
I think it's interesting that you mentioned that, but also it seems like, you know, just from the data that you dove into, you're talking about really expectations and whether they were exceeded or violated in a sense in the case of the negative reviews. How important is it for a retailer not only to establish valid expectations? So sometimes you talk about under promise, over deliver, but you don't want to under promise too much because then you lose business on the front end. How much of it is it about management of expectations and then following through on those expectations?
It's all about that, and also following through, but beating the customer's expectations. And so a good example would be the returns policy. So a lot of companies would say, I don't want to offer free returns policy because if I do, it's going to be too expensive. And I may be selling to an audience which are prone to returning a lot of goods that I sell. well, then the conversion impact of not having free returns or clear returns on your basket conversion is quite significant. It's sort of 4 percentage points of degradation in terms of people dropping out of the basket because of that point. On the other side of the equation is the merchants not really understanding what the fully loaded cost of the returns process is to their merchants. And so that has been vitally important for people who really knock it out of the park and manage their expectations. Clear comms, but they understand the fully loaded cost of serving a particular use case like free returns. And then once they roll that out, it looks expensive at the outset, but then they get that conversion on the back end with regard to the improvement on customer experience, but also the basket conversion, which is obviously most important to drive those sales.
So we know a good customer experience will, in theory, produce a positive review where you're beating those customer expectations. But when you do get a negative review, when you do have negative sentiment of a customer who had negative experience, especially in a setting like what we're seeing now, where a customer might not have a ton of options out there just because a number of retailers have shut down, a number of websites can't fulfill, that type of thing. What can a retailer do to rebuild that customer expectation and experience after that negative review?
So the first thing to do is to make sure that you are availing of as much automation technology on the day-to-day jobs of work that you need to do in operations, in fulfillment, in shipping, and all of the mechanisms around being able to deal with an order. So you should design your back office with the highest degree of automation. And the reason why that's important is because if you go through peak periods of trade, you get flooded with a bunch of orders, which is happy days. But then, of course, you've got that cost impact of having to put a load of people into the back office to be able to service that. If you've got end-to-end automation in place from the buy button all the way through to fulfillment, you can put yourself in a position where you don't have to incur costs when the peak trades arise. And why that's important is it frees you up with resources to be able to deploy dedicated people to the very important task of managing reviews. In other words, never ignore a negative review, always respond, and respond obviously in the public domain. And a lot of people don't do that, although they want to do that, because they don't have the resources, because they've been tied up on other areas of the business. That with today's technology stacks that are available, you should have the resources able to deal with the very important aspect of customer service. So it's all about redeploying your investments, getting automation in, and then being very proactive about funding the right people to provide that level of response to people that give you reviews, negative and positive.
We talk about redeploying those investments, and I wanted to transition to this because Bright Pearl had a really interesting blog post. And I know in this particular circumstance, it was regarding buy online, pickup in store, evaluating if that would be a match for a certain brick and mortar retailer. But the reality of it is some retailers, you know, all the technology that's out there and all of the optionality might not be a correct fit for them. So how can retailers and how does Bright Pearl evaluate what will work best and how those reinvestments should be best deployed in each business?
So there is a challenge out there with regard to the technology stack. There's a massive array of solutions and choice available, and merchants are time poor and essentially don't have much investment historically into the right skill sets to be able to understand what's out there. So that's pretty clear. And in terms of how to approach it, most merchants don't have the experience to be able to assess the technology options that are out there. But I would actually proffer that the most successful merchants that we've got and then we work with, they take a step back first and they look at the macro trends, which we all know is a big shift online, a big shift to workflows like buy online, pick up in store. And they sit down with their teams and they actually map out, well, what are the customer experiences and life cycles that we want to offer in the channels that we want to be amazing in with regard to the ultimate goal of getting great reviews and getting that customer to come back to us. So the first thing that the really good merchants do is they take the time to actually map out those workflows. What are those customer experiences that they want to offer? And that takes the form of flow diagrams and the like. And then the second phase is they share that with a company like Bright Pearl or others in the market, be it for the front of house, so things like the e-commerce store and the POS solution, or be it for the back office with regard to operations. And then it's the vendor's job is to map the customer experiences that the guys want to the workflows that will be required to support those customer experiences. So you haven't really talked anything about technology. You haven't looked at the tech stack. You're just mapping what you want a customer to experience to the workflows that need to be enabled. And then that helps you demystify all of the language that's out there that the vendors can get involved in and remove the discombobulation factor from it, so to speak, for people who are not tech savvy. Just link it back to the customer buying journey. And then the second one is the peer networks are hugely valuable in terms of podcasts like yourself. But there's many, many e-commerce forums that are closed to vendors. And in there, you can get a pretty honest view in terms of the performance of these vendors as it pertains to those workflow experiences that you want to offer your customers. So they're the two areas that I would advise your customers to focus on. And then the third one is make sure that you don't get involved with any vendors unless you've got pure, very clear clarity on the total cost of ownership over a period of time. So really make sure you understand the pricing, make sure how you're going to be charged and have visibility on that and ensure that as you're charged, you're essentially paying less per unit shipped, so to speak, than more. So, you know, avoid the acquire low, retain high strategy that a lot of software companies have out there.
So I wanted to end on this because we were kind of chatting beforehand about how you've observed that all of this change that you had expected to happen maybe over the next 5 years has really happened in the last 2 to 3 months here. So that being said, looking ahead, where do you see the future headed for, you know, not only we can talk about omnichannel solutions, but just in terms of engagement with the consumer in an e-commerce fashion as well?
Our area around the technology used to enable great customer experiences, what we're seeing, and we were seeing this anyway, but it's hugely accelerated by the COVID outbreak, is the move away from platforms that are extremely customizable, very powerful, very customizable, but very expensive. So systems like Magento, which is a historically hugely flexible platform, and a lot of merchants out there have used that to build integrated systems across physical and virtual, including in-store experiences with a bunch of partners. And what we're seeing is a big, big shift as the stores closed down or have been closed during the COVID measures. We've seen merchants begin to plan to move away from those technologies and adopt technologies that are much faster in terms of configuration, setup, and deployment and are out of the box and are not customizable. They're configurable, but they're not customizable. So there's a big shift of dollar spend moving away from the world of customizable, powerful software to the world of configurable, because configurable was born for the online channel. And that channel is got much more mature servicing the physical channel with offerings like buy online and pickup store now is available. And it's pretty commoditized in terms of the tech that's there now. Whereas, you know, 2-3 years ago, you'd be talking major investment for a merchant to build that. And it was sort of the domain of the big enterprise and the big brands alone. Whereas now that's completely changed. And we expect that path to accelerate greatly. And we're already seeing that now in terms of the shift in demand, because customers come to us and they go, I've got Shopify, I've got BigCommerce, I've got Magento. And we're seeing a massive shift towards BigCommerce and Shopify in particular. And that's the technology that's used to create the e-commerce platform and the customer experience at the front end. And we plug into those, obviously, to carry on from there. But that's the major trend that we're seeing was supposed to happen over 5 years. It's literally happening over the period of the next 3 to 6 months. It's quite a wave.
So great insights. Once again, Derek O'Carroll, the CEO of Bright Pearl. Thank you so much for joining us today on the podcast.
Thank you very much.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
We thank Derek O'Carroll once again for joining us here on the podcast. And this is normally the segment where we look ahead to what we might be keeping an eye on for the next week, month, or year. But it's going to be in a more immediate looking ahead, as we do want to preview what we'll be talking about in a few days on the full podcast once Leighton can record with us. First and foremost, we've got a lot of negative news to talk about. Pier 1 announcing that they're going to be closing their stores, maybe not necessarily closing their e-commerce businesses, but we do know they haven't found a bidder for the stores. That coming down the pike. We also got word of a couple of different bankruptcies in retail, but one in particular is catching headlines in JCPenney. Amazon, at least early in the week, said to potentially be interested in JCPenney. We'll talk about what that means and what it might mean for Amazon's current partnership with Kohl's, a direct competitor of JCPenney, and we'll talk about whether that interest might be substantiated from Amazon's perspective. We'll also talk about Walmart's earnings, as they did post an earnings beat that surprised some folks, but Doug McMillon also said, hey, pump your brakes. We haven't potentially seen a concrete trend surrounding COVID-19 purchasing patterns, and so a lot of retailers saying in earnings calls that they do want to be cautious. So those will be the three stories that we'll focus the most on, but of course we'll sprinkle a few extra in there as well, as it'll be kind of a supersized edition of the podcast. Well, once again, a big thanks to Carl Haller of IBM and Derek O'Carroll, the CEO of Bright Pearl, for joining us on today's special episode, and we hope everyone will join us a few days from now when we release an episode full of news and notes from the week in retail.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.